Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, April 2nd. On today's episode of the Roundup, we're going to talk about rural healthcare. For as long as I could remember, rural hospitals have always been in desperate straits. They're always all closing, or they're always on the brink of collapse. But the COVID-19 pandemic seems to have made that more real and less rhetorical today. To talk about the plight of rural hospitals today and to offer solutions to their ongoing problems are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchinson, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
Well, since the topic is rural healthcare, I find myself humming Home on the Range.
I didn't expect that answer. Julie, how about you?
I have been in rural parts of beaches in our country this week, so not clicked into reality. I'm sure I missed a whole host of excitement.
Okay, you're probably better off for it. Before we talk about making rural healthcare sustainable, let's talk about your use of rural healthcare services. Dave, have you ever received care in a rural or small hospital when you were out of town? And if so, what was your experience?
Well, only once, and it was when I was in college, and Forrest Gump made the astute observation that stupid is stupid does. So we had a very steep hill leading down to the dining hall at Colgate, and we used to take our dining trays and slide down it all the time. Well, anyway, I got turned around and smashed my head into the back of a cement barrier that was there, and I got taken to the local hospital in Hamilton, New York. And it was very rural and very small. And the extent of their care was put a Band-Aid on my cut inside my, at that time, very curly and thick hair. And all that did was result in a subsequent procedure by my roommate when he cut the Band-Aid out a couple days later. So my care experience wasn't that great.
But, Okay, interesting. Julie, how about you? Any rural healthcare visits for you or your family?
I just have to say, I just learned a lot about Dave with that story. That was great. You know, my experience has largely been with the Tahoe Forest Hospital in Truckee, California, that was really born to treat ski accidents. So there's a lot of people waiting around for some pretty gnarly things. And while I've only gone there for lab tests, I have to say it's absolutely empty every time I've been there.
Yeah, interesting. I had a similar experience. When the kids were little, one of them had such a bad ear infection that their eardrum burst. It was late and we were out of town. So we went to the ER of a rural hospital. It was empty and we got right in to see the doctor. I think the best part was getting a prescription filled right away from a vending machine in the waiting room. You know, instead of watching a candy bar fall into a tray, we heard pills dropping into a bottle. So I thought that was pretty cool because it was so convenient. Those were the days.
Yeah.
Dave, let's talk about rural healthcare and rural hospitals. What tells you that the rural healthcare crisis is real and why we have to do something about it now rather than later?
Well, Dave, what both your and Julie's stories have in common is the hospitals were empty when you get there. So that's telling. There are 1,844 rural hospitals in America. 1,300 are critical access hospitals, which means they have under 25 beds and operate with a sweetheart cost-plus payment model from Medicare. But even with the cost-plus reimbursement, rural healthcare is struggling and rural hospitals are closing. 180 have closed since 2005. The pace is picking up with 18 closings in 2019 and 20 closings in 2020. These closings are concentrated in the southeastern and south central regions of the country. Prior to the pandemic, almost half of rural hospitals had negative operating margins. That's not good. Just before the pandemic, last February, the consulting company Chartis released a detailed regression analysis with 16 independent variables that identified 453 rural hospitals as vulnerable to closure, 216 as very vulnerable, and another 237 at risk. Then COVID came and hit rural hospitals, as it did all hospitals, very hard, with elective surgeries drying up. The government pumped $3.1 billion into the rural hospital sector through the CARES Act in the form of loans, so repayment is a concern. They've already spent all that money. More importantly, though, is the impact rural hospital closures have on the people they serve. One study found a 6% higher death rate in regions after a rural hospital had closed. A GAO study released in December measured the impact in very practical terms. The increased distances patients had to travel for care jumped from 3.4 miles in 2012 to 23.9 miles in 2018, sometimes much further than that for specialty care, even double, triple those distances. There's also been a significant drop in primary care physician coverage as rural hospitals have closed throughout the country. But the real question is, how urgent is the crisis? And it's certainly very urgent for those suffering reduced care access, particularly given the haphazard nature of rural hospital closures. The answer, however, isn't to pump more investment into failing rural hospitals that are outdated, underutilized, and rarely offer comprehensive services. The right solutions are to address the real day-to-day care and access needs of rural populations with the whole suite of new delivery models, many of them virtual, that get the right care to people when and where they need it. In essence, it's time for new thinking to address this very old problem.
Got it. Thanks, Dave. Julie, how dire is the rural healthcare situation and how is that affecting access to care in rural America?
Well, simply put, Dave, rural hospital closures are bad for your health. We know that a closure leads to higher mortality relatively quickly. One study in 2019 found that death rates in surrounding communities increased nearly 6% after rural hospital closures, and that's without a pandemic. Medicare beneficiaries in counties where hospitals closed had higher percentages of 10 different types of chronic diseases over beneficiaries where hospitals did not close. And what we know about the coronavirus is that people who are obese or live with diabetes, hypertension, asthma, all those chronic diseases are more susceptible to COVID. And rural areas tend to have higher rates of those conditions. So, you know, knowing that those rural residents are also likely to be older, sicker, and poorer, this leaves a lot of them and has left a lot of them very vulnerable to COVID. And here's the problem. Dave talked about the miles traveled to get care when these closures happen. A couple of them that I think are pretty notable cited by the GAO. One, if you have a kid who needs intensive care, getting to pediatric intensive care is on average 75 miles away from some of these communities. And that's not surprising, but it's also not good. A lot of these folks have to travel over 45 miles for optometry. And if you're a child or an adult who needs psychiatric services, those are, you know, 40, 42 miles away from where you live on average. And we know that's not good given what's happened with the pandemic and mental health. If you want urgent care, that's 40 miles away. And one daunting fact I thought was that people who are suffering from alcohol and substance abuse also have to travel about 40 miles. And just think about that population and their ability to travel. I mean, this is tough. It's some of the worst issues have to go travel the farthest. And with COVID, I mean, geez, you know, the mayor of a little town in Alabama called Georgiana was hospitalized 65 miles from his home. And many in his region ended up 4 to 5 hours away at COVID's height. So this has just been exacerbated during COVID. And Dave, I'll make one more point. Beyond the healthcare access issues, there are just pure economic implications of these closures that can't be overlooked. You know, hospitals are often the largest employer in their town. So when they close, unemployment rises. And the doctors, who are likely the highest paid clinical staff there, leave in big numbers. And most others are left un- or underemployed. So these are big issues.
Thanks, Julie. Dave, anything to add to Julie's comments?
Well, Julie properly identifies the crucial role that hospitals, even small rural hospitals, play in local economies. And communities get very attached to their hospitals. The question is, to what extent should broader society be subsidizing those investments simply to keep that hospital operating? This may sound harsh, but much of this investment is a form of municipal welfare. And I think we need to separate out the facility from the healthcare needs of the community and see if we can use the same levels of investment to really dramatically improve access to care, preventive services, and so on. We'll talk about solutions in the second half of this podcast, but that concern about dying local communities is a valid one. And because of that, we've actually disproportionately pumped money into rural healthcare, although it's really not stemming the tide.
Thanks, Dave. Julie, let's pick up where Dave left off and talk about solutions to the rural healthcare crisis. What do you see as some short-term and some long-term solutions? What would you recommend?
Well, for years, policymakers have been, as Dave said, applying some traditional band-aids, like one-time payments to make up for revenue loss, like what's happening for the pandemic, or technical assistance to attempt to improve local efficiency. Many have advocated for expanding the definition of critical access hospitals, which receive cost-based payment from Medicare. But these and a bunch of other, you know, different payment approaches simply don't get around the fact that the business model for most of these rural hospitals is just wrong. It's not working for them. They can't cover their costs. You know, the Center for Healthcare Quality and Payment Reform recommended the creation of a new patient-centered payment system that would be entirely different way to pay rural hospitals for services that effectively cover the cost of infrastructure. And I like the idea of aligning financial incentives with what needs to happen to keep hospitals open, but there may not be an appetite for an entirely new payment model, and the associated administrivia could increase dramatically to support a different method. And you know what? This won't surprise either of you, but I personally believe that this is what telehealth was made for. Telehealth distributes capacity to enable access in places where capacity can't exist. And when we start to really think about whether telehealth is provided by a nearby system or a health plan's network of virtual providers, some believe that 95% of primary care can be addressed virtually. And of course, we're seeing mental health care be addressed virtually quite well. And this won't address all care, of course. And it may mean that travel for the sickest patients is still a reality. And I'd like to think that we could take some of the bricks and mortar locations and repurpose them for certain types of in-person care that have more of an inpatient telehealth model for the more complex cases. And that would maintain some of the local employment, just, you know, redistribute how you think about the staffing there. But the business models need to evolve and see a new way of segmenting care and delivering with more modalities and rational approaches.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Dave, what can payment reforms and market-based solutions like telemedicine do to make care more accessible and more affordable in rural America?
Well, let me pick up on that patient-centered payment system that Julie mentioned. It was a report that came out from the Center for Healthcare Quality and Payment Reform last September. It had five parts: standby capacity payments to support the fixed cost of essential services, service-based fees for diagnostic and treatment services based on marginal cost, patient-based payments for primary care management, accountability for quality and spending, and value-based cost sharing for patients. That's certainly better than what's in place now, but it does have a pretty heavy regulatory feel to it. And maybe at the end of the day, we're going to end up with kind of a utility approach to rural healthcare that has to be centrally managed in this way. But I hope that's not the case. I like to believe that if we shifted to a pure population health payment model where vertically integrated payers and providers have responsibility for the care of specific populations in rural areas, that they'll take advantage of a lot of the new types of virtual services and lower cost in-person care delivery models. You know, think of clinics and Walmarts and at-home care provided by local LPNs and so on. Just to think bigger and out of the box about getting the care people need in the most convenient and rational ways, and giving up on the idea that we're going to have all acute care services in local communities. I mean, it just isn't going to pay for itself. But what we can do is stabilize people that are in need of acute interventions and get them to places that can handle their needs much more effectively than we do in these sort of far-flung rural hospitals that in many ways are a throwback to the 50s and 60s, you know, a bygone era, Hill-Burton investments. So we may end up with more of a utility approach. I hope that's not the case. I think market-driven solutions with the proper payment models behind them can really stimulate innovation and deliver real results where it counts, which is for the people that live in these rural communities.
Interesting. Thanks, Dave. Julie, anything to add to Dave's comments?
Well, Dave just said a few things that I think made me realize one thing we're not talking about here, which is the impact of the Walmarts in the rural communities and the announcement a few weeks ago about Amazon Care. Consumers in these communities will have access to a lot of primary care resources. So this really starts to become exclusively about acute care. And Dave's population health model, we need to get to a different way of thinking about payment and care structuring. And if we can take primary care and maybe even some of the mental health off the table and serve them in different ways, it might leave us with a new way to think about the real problem here.
Amen to that, Julie.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, thank you. All right. Now, as always on the roundup, let's talk about next week. Julie, what do you see on the horizon for healthcare in the week ahead?
Well, I'm just going to give you my hope and dream, which is that we get out of this really gray, fuzzy area right now where we're talking about how COVID numbers are increasing in a couple places and the impact of the spring breakers in Miami returning home and all of that. And we hear the news that we are getting ahead of this with the vaccine, because right now, depending upon who you're listening to, you could either be super optimistic or really pessimistic. So I hope we hear that we're really rounding a corner and making a difference.
Here, here. Dave, what's the healthcare news knocking on your door next week?
Well, I tend to look for the underreported stories. And one that's got me fascinated is the big pickup in enrollment on the Obamacare exchanges after the passage of the $1.9 billion Rescue Act, which dramatically decreased premiums. And obviously, if people want health insurance, and if the price is right, they'll buy it. And so we've seen a big pickup in that way. And that corresponds with some real innovation with the state-based exchanges, particularly in California, where Julie is. And I think this combination of more robust enrollment and better operation of the state exchanges may be one of the sort of hidden benefits of market-based reform. And I think that will become more apparent as the Biden administration actively starts to market the exchanges to the American people. So we could see a big uptick in coverage, which will improve access. Obviously, we've got other issues to address well, but getting people into the system is a big one.
That's good. Thanks, Dave. And thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. The time has come to fix rural healthcare. I think we all agree on that. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed today, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can find a recording of this podcast and all our podcasts on the Healthcare Now Radio Network, iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming services. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.